figure thinking about the sea scurvy.
About our expedition, which might help us get all to remember what life was like 25 years ago. Starting with Midsky, you remember there were two ships, the Horizon and a ship called the EPCER something. I forgot the name of it, the number of it. But the characteristic thing about the EPCER, whatever it was that it broke down. and this was not, as far as I could see, quite an act of God. It had something to do with the crew. And Jim Fawn and I, on the Horizon, had all the oil. We managed to get this EPCER so far from San Diego they couldn't get back without refueling. And Jim was very careful to measure the amount of fuel we gave them every other day so that they couldn't. It was not enough to get to San Diego. So we got them all the way to the equator and all the way back to Hawaii on a short leash. Two or three days of fuel each time. Remember, Jim? you were very careful about this, very measuring every drop. But when these guys got to Hawaii, they sent a cable to their wives saying, we're going to spend the rest of the summer in Pearl Harbor. Please join us. And I went to the commandant of the Navy Yard, who was an admiral. And I thought this was a very important Natural Science Foundation expedition. I shouldn't be delayed for any reason whatever. And please get this EPCER out of the Navy Yard as soon as you possibly could. He gave them, instead of the bottom priority, the top priority. We went on the Horizon to the Pacific Mountains. And before anybody could possibly believe it, pretty soon the EPCER was going to do it. And they stayed all the rest of the way. I don't know what happened to their wives. Remember, Dad, that we had a group of you people camping on Bikini in a tropical paradise, sort of. All the rest of us lived on a ship. And this was a kind of a thing which we hadn't expected to have a camp on the beach. That's about all I remember about MidPack, except that in the Mid-Pacific Mountains, Ed Hamilton was finding wonderful fossils, and really we thought we were revolutionizing the world because of what we were finding out about this ancient mountain range, which extended from the Hawaiian Islands west all the way to Wake Island. On Capricorn, well, coming back to Midpack for a minute, after we had all been at the Bikini for a while, the ship, of course, had to get home again, and Jeff Crouchy led the ship, led the expedition home. And that was the first time that anybody had realized the nature of the great fracture zones in the Pacific Ocean, the huge cliff that extended for 1,000 miles or so along the Mendocino Escarpment. I remember also Russ Ray first making his famous aphorism, that day is lost whose low descending sun sees no sightseeing run. Coming down to Capricorn, memories flood back about Capricorn. And one of them I remember is on Falcon Island. Falcon Island was a disappearing island west of the Tonga Islands. It's an active volcano. Every now and then it explodes and piles up a huge pile of cinders several hundred feet above sea level. Then the waves come and wash it away. And most of the time it's about 20 or 30 feet below sea level. And we decided, for reasons I don't quite remember now, that we would investigate Falcon Island. dead bodies of our captives, we went right to the top of this shoal, this island from shallow bend. And as I remember, as we came into the Falcon Island, we were rather scared at the depth of too shallow. We started to back up. Art Maxwell came rushing up to the bridge and said, "We're aground." And what had happened was that the wake of the ship had created an echo, which was shallower than the ship itself. Actually, the bottom of the bank was still about 20 feet down. But for a moment, we that was the end of the expedition right there. Walter and several other people dived on the top of Falcon Island. I remember Walter decided that his mission in life was to measure the temperature of this submerged volcano. He stuck a thermometer into it under the rock and happened to look around. There was a shark looking over his shoulder, reading the thermometer along with him. There was nothing really to do but just to go on reading the temperature. Eventually, this shark lost interest and went away, and Walter is still here. It was very shortly after that Helen Rayton joined the expedition at Tonga. She had been meeting us at the different ports we landed at, and by this time it seemed that she really belonged to the expedition and to us, so she joined us there and went home the rest of the way with us. And this was in some way a great first. She was the first woman, so far as I know, who ever took part in a major oceanographic expedition. She wrote a book about it. It began her long love affair with the Tonga Islands, and particularly with the magical island of Vavao. Actually, I had asked Rachel Carson to come along with the expedition to write a book about it, and she had planned to do so, but at the last minute she couldn't do it. So Helen's book, Exploring the Deep Pacific, is, I think, a worthy surrogate for Rachel Carson. It's one that arouses memories and nostalgia and the wonderful enthusiasm, naivete, and sensibility that Helen's book has, I think, still fills us all with good feeling. It was on that expedition in the Fiji Islands that I realized the difference between a director and a captain. We were exploring a narrow passage in the Fiji Islands, and Larry Davis was the skipper of the day. He was obviously quite nervous about this, but I insisted on keeping on sounding and really trying to find out what the shape of this narrow gulf was like in the Fijis. And pretty soon it became close to sunset, and I realized that we'd gotten ourselves in a very tight spot. And it was only by Larry Davis's skillful navigation and calmness and thoughtfulness that we got out. I was very much at fault. I've been very much at fault for insisting that you stay too long and you try to do too much in the face of the safety of the ship. It was on Capricorn that we explored the Tonga Trench, one of the most remarkable features of the Earth. I remember very well one of the exciting parts of it was the discovery of Bob Fisher's Island, or Bob Fisher's Mountain. It's a mountain that rises, if you will, from 35,000 feet to about 1,500 feet below the sea surface. So in some ways, the highest mountain in the world, although Bob never claimed that. He claimed it just rises from the side of the trench. So it's only about 26,000 feet. We were trying to sound the Tonga Trench. Some of you will remember, all of you will remember, we were on the expedition. We had a new winch and a new wire, a tapered cable, an ordinary cable which is the same diameter all the way down, won't hold its own weight when you get beyond about 25,000 feet. The bottom of the Tonga Trench was 35,000 feet. We had a tapered cable, a cable that was big at the top, small at the bottom. And we had a new winch that we didn't understand very well, and probably wasn't very well designed. The result was that every now and then this wire would get snarled. The cable would, like a fishing reel, would overrun, and the wire would come off the reel and get kinked and snarled. And we had about 25,000 feet of wire out over the Tonga Trench when this happened. I think that was the worst 24 hours of my life, and maybe some of you will remember. We had to take a fire clamp on the part of the cable that was hanging over the side, cut the cable, remove all the snarl parts, and bring the wire and winch and splice it on again. And it worked, and we didn't lose anybody or anything. But it was a very, very bad 24 hours. I still have the shudders when I think about it. As you know, on Capricorn, as well as on Mizpah, we had two ships, and of course we had two watches on each ship. The characteristic thing about people is that they have a team spirit and they're competitive. And I well remember that on one watch, the people on the other watch were always lazy and slow. They always arrived late, they always left early, they never cleaned up. They were a bunch of bums. Until somehow you get transferred to the other watch. And of course it turned out that everybody on your watch arrived late, left early, never cleaned up. We're really a bunch of bums. Now this was exacerbated on Capricorn by the fact that we had two ships. The center of affairs and Horizon. And everybody on the Horizon from the standpoint of the center of affairs. You know, they never did anything right. They had just a series of wrong ideas. And of course exactly the same thing was true on Big on the Horizon. That those guys on Baird were a bunch of arbitrary bastards. Didn't really understand how to do science, let alone how to make an expedition work. So finally we traded people from one ship to the other. And the people who traded decided that the people on their ship, who'd been on their previous ship, were really a bunch of bums. And the people on their new ship were full of virtue. This is one of the great things about a multi-ship, multi-watch expedition. I remember also walking down the streets of Nuku'alofa, capital of Tonga, on Christmas Day, on Christmas Eve, actually. There was Wim Horton and John Isaacs and me and Gus Arrhenius and two or three other people who were all about 6 feet 2 inches tall. Maybe Bob Livingston was one of them. And all of the Tongans in general are about 5 feet 6 inches tall. And we were a very impressive and somewhat overpowering sight, walking all abreast down the streets of Nuku'alofa. The next morning we all went to church, and the Tongans sang Christmas carols and Christmas hymns. One of the interesting things about them was that they were sung in Tongan. And the result, as you might expect, every other language is the words are much longer than they are in English. And half the verse in an English version took up the whole four lines or whatever the cadence is in the Tongan version. The hymns were just exactly twice as long in Tongan as they have been in English. On that expedition, Bob Livingston, wherever he went, took recordings of the songs that the Fijians and the Tongans and the Marquesans and the Tahitians sang. Some of those you've heard tonight are still as fresh and as wonderful as they were then. When we got to the Marquesas Islands, I remember something rather special. There was an old trader there who'd been there for about 40 years named Rob McKittery. He told us a wonderful story. He said when he first went there, he sold shoes to the Polynesians. That's hard to believe, but he did. The average shoe size was size 12. By the time we got there, he said the average shoe size was size 8. And what was the possible reason for this? I think the reason was a seminal immigrant. been about five Chinese who lived in the Marquesas, and almost everybody who was then alive, almost the entire population, were the descendants, one way or the other, of these five Chinese. I think they mingled their semen with the Polynesian population, and the result was that the Marquesas were surviving because of the Chinese toughness. And one of the other aspects of it was that their feet had gotten very much smaller. I remember also one of the places we went to was Palmerston Island. Palmerston Island was about the most isolated place that I could possibly think of. In the middle of the South Pacific, ships fall there somewhere on the average about once every 7 or 8 years, at least it used to. It had first been found by Captain Cook in one of his expeditions in the 1760s, and he'd surveyed the island. He concluded that there were very strong currents around the island, two knot currents or more, and that statement of Captain Cook has been repeated in the pilot book ever since. Except if you look carefully, you read that the ship called there in 1875 and couldn't find any currents. There was another ship around 1900 that reported no currents. We surveyed around the atoll, and we found no currents. And what had happened clearly was that Captain Cook, in his survey, had depended on sextant sights on the atoll. The only landmarks were palm trees, and he'd lost them. And it was very easy to think he'd mistaken one palm tree for the other as he went around the atoll. We had the great benefit of a recording echo sounder, with the result that we could actually make a closure, and there were no currents at all. So this was, for me at least, an enormous satisfaction to be able to do better than Captain Cook, the greatest explorer and the greatest navigator who ever lived. Remember, on Palmerston Atoll, as we hove to offshore, there were three little boats that came out of the passage out into the open sea. They all came alongside. The first boat, a little brown man wearing a hat and no shirt, jumped out and came up on deck and said, "Hello, I'm Ben. I'm out of the first boat." And a few minutes later, the second little boat came alongside. Another little brown man jumped out and said, "Hello, I'm Charlie. I'm out of the second boat." And pretty soon, a third little brown man out of the third boat said, "Hello, I'm Will. I'm out of the third boat." It turned out that Palmerston Atoll had been a completely deserted atoll until 1863, when it was settled by a man named Ben Marston, an English sailor, who brought along three Tahitian women with him. He'd had children by all three of them. And there are now 400 or so descendants of Ben, or there were in 1952, God knows how many there are now. But in 1952, there were 400 descendants of Ben Marston, 75 of whom were living on the atoll. Now, this was my first experience with the population. I've never really thought about it before, and in fact, this is a kind of a microcosm of the population problem. These people knew that after a hurricane, that the limit of the number of people who could live on the island was 75. And that was the number that they limited their population to. They had about, Ben Marshall had about 400 descendants, but they pushed everybody else off to New Zealand and to Rarotonga and to Samoa and to many other places. They were all over the South Pacific. Now, ordinarily, the atoll could easily support 400 or 500 people, but after a hurricane, all the coconut trees were knocked down and only fish were their means of survival. That was the limit of the number they could have. And that was the number that they did have. And this is the kind of rational calculation that human beings make if they have a chance to do so. And this is what gives me some, changing the subject drastically, this is what gives me some hope about the world's so-called population problem. Well, we could go on, and I hope we will go on for quite a long time, telling sea stories about this expedition. But I'd like to say one other thing, and that is that we were right at the end of the beginning of one of the great ages of exploration. Quite obvious now that the the 15 or 20 years from 1948 to 1965 were one of the great ages of discovery of the Earth. And the things that we found and the things that our expeditions found later, the things that Horace Ewing and his group and Teddy Bullard and his group and some of the people at Woods Hole found, between us, we laid the basis for a scientific revolution. A scientific revolution of the most profound kind. In some ways, perhaps not as important to human beings spiritually or psychologically as the Darwinian revolution, nevertheless intellectually and in terms of a complete change in understanding, at least as profound a revolution as the Darwinian revolution about the nature of living things. And I think this is we were lucky, of course. There's nothing in this world that happens without luck. We were lucky to be at the right place at the right time. We're also lucky that we have so many people who were curious and able and interested and excited and willing to try to spend their lives in conditions that were often very pleasant, trying to find out what the world is all about. Finally, let me just end up with one, not exactly sea story, but to give some flavor of what happened. I remember very well Bill Menard saying after two or three expeditions that one of the things that I find about these oceanographic expeditions is that every time I get back, it becomes crazy. Every time I get to return, it's going to come out of the way.